Welcome back, long-suffering listeners, to the show that you've been waiting for with the most grandiose introduction of all internet podcast radio shows on the internet today. It is Riddles in the Dark, brought to you by the Mythgard Institute. I am your co-host, Dave Kale, and I am bringing to you the two most insightful, interesting to listen to, and wonderful to discuss with co-hosts you could possibly imagine. The illustrious Tolkien professor, Corey Olson, and Trish Lambert. And now you will finally get to hear us dive into Desolation of Smaug. So let's just get right to it.
Okay, good. One very quick announcement at the beginning is that we have a new feature on the Mythgard.org website. Many people have been asking for and hoping for a chat window so that you guys can talk amongst yourselves during the episode. And we now have that capability. So if you go to the Riddles in the Dark page on Mythgard.org, it is Mythgard.org/exclusives/Riddles in the Dark. But if you just Google Mythgard and Riddles in the Dark, you'll find it. In fact, I was delighted to see when I just Googled Riddles in the Dark this morning that our page was the third on the Google list, actually.
Oh, awesome.
Which, given the fact, you know, that's obviously the name of the chapter of Tolkien's book, I thought that was pretty cool. So anyway, if you Google Mythgard and Riddles in the Dark, you'll find it. And then on the bottom right-hand corner of that page is our new chat interface. So click on that, and you can enter into the chat with anybody else who wants to. So we have that new feature, so I hope you will take advantage of that, and now we'll begin on the other, actually, that's the only announcement I had here at the beginning. So, what we're wanting to do...
Let's face it, people would much prefer to be talking to each other than listening to us.
Well, you know, exactly. we will carry on talking and provide a background, you know, to the chat that you guys can have there.
Well, and actually, I guess the chat is up 24/7, 365. So, like, if two people wanted to listen to the podcast simultaneously, you know, then they could get on the chat room.
That's right. Asynchronous and, Riddles, you know, in the Dark chatting. Why not? Absolutely.
That's right.
Absolutely. You just want to randomly decide to hang out in our chat window and chat with people. You're absolutely free to do that. Yeah. Okay. What we're going to do today is we're going to follow up. You know, last week we had a very theoretical discussion about reactions to the films and about things to do and not to do. And by the way, can I just say that the more I have thought about our crit fiction discussion, the happier I have been with it. I've had some really great exchanges from. With listeners who have been talking about it on Twitter, especially, there have seemed to be a lot of people who have really kind of resonated with that concept. And the more I've thought about it, the more useful I find it. So I just wanted to kind of mention that again because I think that's really useful. But today we're going to go and we're going to do some more specific analysis. We're essentially going to do in practice the kind of general thing we were talking about last time. We said last time that really the only fair way to discuss these things, rather than just getting bogged down in the similarity, in the sort of the superficial similarities and differences, even where the superficial differences are profound, is to really compare the cores. Trish was quoting the letter where Tolkien talks about that, about, you know, the importance of an adaptation being true to the core of the original. And so our question is basically, what is the core of the original, and what really are the thematic cores of the Desolation of Smaug? And I would emphasize cores because, you know, to try to take either the film or the book and just sort of try to condense it into one, singular theme or idea, obviously, I think, too much of a simplification. I mean, I couldn't point. I mean, I've thought a lot about The Hobbit, of course, and I couldn't point to like one single thing which represents the core of The Hobbit. And I think it's, you know, even, you know, sometimes people will quote Tolkien's words, when talking about the Lord of the Rings or the Silmarillion or any of that stuff, and say, well, Tolkien said that the major theme was death and mortality, which he did say that several times. But one thing I would recall there is that even when Tolkien talked about that, he immediately qualified that, or not qualified that, but he immediately almost, well, not exactly laughed at himself, but he almost made light of it by saying you know, he said the central theme of the Lord of the Rings is mortality. And then he adds, but really that's just as much as to say it was written by a human. You know, that is, yeah. You know, basically the point that he makes is that, you know, on some level, all works of art by human beings are interested in mortality as sort of a central thing. That it is a deep core interest of all mortal beings, and so therefore, of course, it is a major feature of the Lord of the Rings as well. In other words, even to say what Tolkien said, even when Tolkien said what he said about what the core of the Lord of the Rings was, he was recognizing that that's, you know, a very big generalization, and that's really taking the whole thing out to a level which doesn't really do justice to the whole story, you know, to everything that he talks about. So, therefore, what we're going to do today is we're going to look at a couple different sort of themes and ideas in the film. We're going to start with the film and then go backwards to the book, because, you know, we've talked about the book a lot. You know, I wrote a book about the book, and you know, so we already have, I hope, among us, a pretty good groundwork of having thought carefully about the book first. So I want to apply, you know, some similar careful thought about the films, looking at a couple major movements in the films, thinking about what are really the core thematic interests of the movie, and then we'll bring those back and compare those to some of those core thematic ideas of the book. So that's what we're going to do today. And there are three themes that I've kind of isolated, or three, as I said, sort of movements in the film. And the first one I want to talk about is the Gandalf versus the Necromancer, the kind of light versus darkness theme that we get in the confrontation between Gandalf and the Necromancer, really thinking sort of in larger terms of that entire element. Because, of course, there are ways in which that, and it doesn't have to be just a consideration of when Gandalf actually fights against the Necromancer, really that the whole Gandalf movement, but also the way in which that particular theme is also touched upon in the other stories. Because, of course, with the way that the Gandalf passages are interwoven with the rest of the storytelling in the movie, it really invites us to think about those side by side. I mean, I think, for instance, about the most, at least what I thought was the most noticeable cut between the Bilbo and Thorin story and the Gandalf story in the film, was that moment when they are looking out over the ruins of Dale, and, you know, it's like, this is the desolation of the dragon, and Bilbo suggests waiting for Gandalf, which is what Gandalf told them to do, in fact, and Thorin, you know, says, do you see the wizard? No, neither do I, let's go. And at that moment, you know, when Bilbo is sitting there obviously saying, like, where's Gandalf, and I wonder what's going on, that's when we cut to Gandalf going into Dol Guldur. So I think that, you know, my point there is simply the fact that Gandalf entering Dol Guldur and trying to expose the Necromancer and fight against evil is obviously being paralleled by that cut with them entering into the mountain. You know, they've come to the brink of the desolation of Smaug just as Gandalf goes into Dol Guldur. So again, that is just one example of how I would suggest we can sort of think about some of the Gandalf and Thorin things in conjunction with this theme as well. So, okay. First, observations. Before we draw any conclusions, we have to sort of collect our data. What elements of the film do you think contribute to this? I mean, obviously we've got the fight between Gandalf and the Necromancer, right? The final standoff is, I think, really the central element of this theme, so we might as well start with that. And the visuals there, I think, are quite striking. And it's interesting to me that we, and this is slightly tangential, but the way in which they depict Gandalf's magic functioning in his exploration of Dol Guldur, and in particular in his fight with the Necromancer there at the end, is very interesting to me. And it's a little bit, I thought, a little bit of a departure. One of the challenges, and this has been a serious challenge for translating Tolkien's works into film from the beginning, is how do you deal with magic? So much of the magic in Tolkien's world is not visible. It's spiritual and abstract. You know, and to point to one obvious scene, the confrontation between Gandalf and Saruman, there's, you know, both of them are using magic, as hobbits would call it. But no, there's nothing visual seen. Everything that happens is mental, and a struggle of wills between the two of them. In order to put that on film, you can't show what's going on inside people's heads. And you certainly, it's very difficult to depict a sort of abstract struggle of wills. And so therefore, if you just depicted exactly what is described in the book, what you will show on screen is two people talking to each other. And that won't give you any kind of the sense of, you know, the significance of what's actually going on there in the actual book. So in the, well, I guess it wasn't in the Two Towers film, was it? It was in the very beginning of the Return of the King film. The extended edition.
You have an opportunity to use your sizable special effects budget.
right. Well,
also
see,
very important.
Exactly. In the Return of the King film, Saruman throws a fireball at Gandalf, which then just like bursts around him and doesn't affect him. And I've always felt that that was an understandable but really clumsy way to try to convey this. I sort of sympathized. I mean, I remember my first reaction when I saw Saruman throw a fireball at Gandalf in the film. And that was, my first reaction was, oh, that was really lame. And then my second reaction was kind of sympathy. Like, you know, I see what you're trying to do there. I understand that you want to show that this is, in fact, on some level, a wizard's duel. But that was really kind of lame. I think that it's interesting that they went in a different direction in The Desolation of Smaug, when they were trying to show a magical confrontation between Gandalf and the Necromancer. And of course, a lot of people have been making fun of the sort of, you know, inky cloud thing that is attacking Gandalf, and it, you know, looking like Gandalf is fighting off a magical cloud of ink. But I mean, what is clearly being done there is sort of showing the conflict between their wills in a way which is visible. And I actually found it less irritating than the fireball, even though it runs the risk of being a lot more hokey than even what he did in The Return of the King. But I think it does a far better job of illustrating visually, which again I think is so challenging, illustrating visually what is actually going on there. And the way that they represented it visually as light and darkness. And I actually liked the CG treatment of the darkness, you know, that it was not just Gandalf in the middle of, you know, a solid cloud of blackness, but the way that that you could see, you know, it is like darkness made visible. It is as if darkness were trying to form a tangible shape so that it looked like a mist rather than just an absence of light. You know, this sort of positive mist of darkness that is trying to encroach upon Gandalf, in which he is beating off with the light, and you have this, you know, this pure sphere of light around Gandalf, which, you know, the darkness is trying to close in on. You know, again, there are lots of critiques one could make on a purely visual level. You know, that and it's easy, I think, to laugh at the visuals in that scene. Though again, I don't know how I would do it. I don't know how I would do it better.
I didn't really. I mean, for me, the there's two things about that scene that evoke for me the Lord of the Rings movies. And when I'm just talking movies here, I'm not talking books. What you're talking about, I think, is, and I can't remember if Cate Blanchett says it in the prologue, but the whole thing about once the ring was cut off his finger, he couldn't take, you know, corporeal shape. You know, for me, having an inky cloud, it was kind of like, well, what else are you going to do? Because I already knew he couldn't take actually a, you know, a sustainable human form. I looked upon that ever increasing eye with the armor on thing more like a illusion.
Yes.
As opposed to that he was actually physically standing there. I think that scene is going to make more sense once future generations see these movies in quote unquote Middle Earth chronological order.
Right.
And you almost want to have the prologue from Lord of the Rings, from Fellowship of the Ring, before this scene even happens.
Right.
You know, because then it makes more sense. The second thing was the fight evoked for me the fight that he has with Saruman and Orthanc. I mean, poor old Gandalf gets, same thing, you know, he ends up pinned up against a wall.
Right.
The one difference is, of course, he gets, you know, tree-rooted versus getting spun up to the top of Orthanc. But again, I think people in the future generations seeing this movie, if they see this movie first, it's going to be one of the things that makes it obvious Saruman has gone over to Sauron's side, is that he kind of has a very similarly choreographed fight with Gandalf, ending in the same, you know, Gandalf pinned up against a wall thing. So I thought that was kind of an interesting parallel.
Yeah, I do. I also do agree with that. I mean, you know, to thinking of how this works, not just thinking of the special effects and how they're depicting magic, but thinking about, again, thematically, what's going on here. And let's put the confrontation there, that final confrontation between Gandalf and the Necromancer, in the larger context of Gandalf's whole trip into Dol Guldur. And this, I thought, was very interestingly done. You know, thinking of the scene, you know, the scene that was included in most of the trailers, the, you know, it's most definitely a trap scene. What are we understanding? How are we to understand, do you guys think, what Gandalf is doing there? Does does he know he's going to be taken captive? Is he springing the trap because he goes in believing he can handle it? Is this a self-sacrificial move on Gandalf's part?
I mean, that may be answered in the third movie, but for me, the part that was missing, and I can only make this up, which, of course, you've taught me not to do, so I'm very, very wary about doing this, but because of the High Fells trip, you know, the trip they took to the High Fells, I would have liked there to have been some indication, if this was true, that he was going into Dol Guldur expecting to meet the Witch King, not Sauron. You know, to me, that would have, first of all, tied together the whole trip to the Fells. Second of all, would explain why he would go in thinking he would be able to, you know, counter the evil force, is because he's expecting to see the Witch King, not the big bad.
Right.
But he never said that, so I have to make that up, and that's not, you know, I mean, that's not obvious to us.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, that's hard because it's one of those moments which you always have to be so cautious about, where it's tempting to import information that we have not from the movies but from the books. You know, where we know that, you know, according to the books, Gandalf and Elrond and the rest of them were suspecting that the Necromancer was one of the Ringwraiths. We might be tempted to fill that blank in that way, but of course we don't know that that's in fact the decision that the filmmakers were making and had in mind.
And without that, I mean, it is a little bit ludicrous. I mean, it is a little bit ludicrous if what Jackson wants us to believe is he really thought it was Sauron going into it. Then your question is even more. It's like, why on earth, you know, would he do that? And I think we can't answer it. But did he do it knowing it was a trap and that was going to like draw the rest of the White Council? I don't know.
I can't imagine that though. When he sends Radagast off after Galadriel, I don't think that Gandalf would actually believe that he needs to put himself as bait in order to draw Galadriel there. He knows she'll help. So I mean, the question would be then, well, okay, so why doesn't, if Gandalf is going to send Radagast after Galadriel, why doesn't he wait, for one thing? He could just wait for Galadriel and go in together. I'm kind of hoping, of course, I've talked about this many times, I am coming into the period of waiting for the extended edition of The Desolation of Smaug with the hope that we're going to get about an hour more footage, you know, because like when I add up the total number of things that I trust, assume, and hope we're going to get learn more about in the extended edition, the list gets very long, actually. So,
and not just an hour more footage, but an hour more footage of actually useful information, not right. naked dwarves, not, right, exactly. you know, marketplaces, stuff like
yes.
that.
Yes, yes. Yeah, no, I do have to say, the extended edition of the first film was very disappointing in that way. But sorry, Dave, go ahead.
I wanted to comment, go back to your comment about the light versus dark visuals. It makes me think of your most recent, most recent Tolkien chat, where someone asked about the comment that Gandalf makes about, I am Gandalf the White, but black is still is stronger. For,
yes.
I kind of wonder if they were thinking of that line when they wrote up this scene and designed the visuals and that kind of stuff. And I'll be honest with you, like I'm one of the inky cloud complainers, and I think part of it is just because basically if you've seen Lost, you can't, it's impossible not to think of the smoke monster from Lost, and Then you're now thinking of Sauron as the smoke monster, which is not really the most like dignified name to assign to a big evil bad guy.
Right.
So, you know, basically, it's not necessarily their fault or a bad thing, but it's just my mind has been polluted by by another piece of art.
Yes, well, I do know. I mean, I haven't seen Lost, so I didn't have that. But I know that, you know, I have several friends who have, right. and between the
you're
presence
aware.
Of Evangeline Lilly and then the smoke monster, they also found that connection absolutely inescapable.
Thank God they didn't have Dominic Monaghan in this movie too. Oh,
right,
God,
right.
Really, or any of the other actors. So I suspect I'd be the kind of I'm the sort of fan that probably just about anything they would have done I would have been dissatisfied with. I certainly wouldn't have liked it any better if they'd had Sauron show up in his armored form from
right.
the Lord of the Ring prologue, and had him standing there with the staff casting spells at Gandalf and have sort of a Dungeons and Dragons LARP style battle. That
right.
would have been awful too.
Right.
So, you know, in fairness, when I think about how might they have done that confrontation that I would be completely satisfied with and say, yeah, that's excellent. I don't think there's probably anything they could have done. And so taking a step back and thinking about sort of what you're suggesting, which is what they're trying to do is not necessarily have a faithful visual execution of exactly how that scene transpired in the books, but rather a visually interesting, you know, and that's certainly one of the criteria is it needs to actually be kind of fun to watch for the fans. So fair enough, let's admit
right.
that. But just have a visual metaphor almost for what exactly happens or what we can imagine happen in that confrontation. Gandalf sneaks into Dol Guldur, discovers it's Sauron. And just barely escapes eventually. What would that look like? And I think you're right. Like, I think something like this, a very, very visual illustration of the power of darkness that Sauron wields, which at this point is stronger. Well, it's always stronger than Gandalf is.
Yes.
Versus sort of the power of light that Gandalf wields. Like, you're right. I actually... In sort of at least in my head, even if not in my sort of instinctual reaction, I actually like this at least better than the Saruman Gandalf sorcery off.
Right.
You know, instead of them sort of kinetic energy staff wielding, beating each other up, like this was a lot more just sort of visceral. Like, you know, this was a confrontation of wills of one of the good guys and one of the much more powerful bad guys, and doing it this way, like I kind of like it. I think what I would have liked is if Sauron had been sort of a figure wielding the dark instead of him being the inky smoke monster thing, like, you know, being sort of the vague necromancerish shadow type thing, kind of like he was in the first movie. But still, at the end of the day, it is kind of a nice visual representation of how these sorts of confrontations go down in Tolkien, that it really is a struggle of wills.
Yes. So, yes. And as to that last point, I suspect, based on the very slight reveal of the shadowy, vaguely humanoid figure that we got in film one for the Necromancer, I'm perfectly willing to believe that that's actually happening, but he's dark and in the darkness and therefore not visible. So all we see is this, is, you know, just as with Gandalf, we see the white light emanating from him. So we see the shadow, which is, I presume, emanating from and not in fact identical with the Necromancer. But the difference, of course, is that the light that Gandalf is emitting illuminates him, whereas the shadow that comes from the Necromancer conceals him. And actually, I find that sort of thematically, allegorically, morally appropriate, really. So I do kind of like that. I don't think that we're necessarily supposed to understand that the shadow is the Necromancer here any more than that the flaming eyeball really is Sauron in The Lord of the Rings. But again, the fact that Gandalf himself is revealed by the light, that we can, you know, that we can see Gandalf standing at the center of the light, is I get to me symbolically, I think that that works really well. I forgot the other thing I wanted to say about that. Never mind. Totally lost my train of thought. Dave, I wanted to pick up on the other point that you made. I thought, because the business with like the kinetic power of their staffs and the way that we see, you know, the confrontation between Gandalf and Saruman, not the second one that I was referring to at the beginning of The Return of the King, but the Fellowship of the Ring, Slugfest, the way that that was corporealized, it did end up being really, really kind of silly. But think about the way that they took that similar idea, but really transformed it, I think, effectively in The Desolation of Smaug, which is Gandalf's confrontation with Azog, when he sort of hits him with his staff in almost the same gesture that he used against Saruman in that fight. But instead of just, you know, hurling some kinetic force at him, he commands him, right? I mean, too is obviously a battle of will, and the battle of wills between Gandalf and Azog is one that Gandalf wins handily, right? So there we see, Gandalf asserting his power and his will,
right?
And Azog is literally helpless against him when he does that.
Which is actually good, because that gives us the calibration.
Exactly.
Words, it allows the audience to sort of calibrate, okay, Gandalf can take out Azog easy, and then when he goes up against Sauron, then you're like, whoa, okay, now we're really impressed with Sauron's power, because
right. We
saw what Gandalf could do before. Yeah.
Right. And so, I mean, I thought that was really well done. And I agree with you, Trish, I think when you were saying about when the flaming eyeball is revealed and Sauron sort of walks out as the pupil, and then especially that sort of trippy gif effect of
You Which know. People in Colorado will love.
Exactly. That passage, you know precisely the one I mean.
Yes.
I really like your characterization of that as basically not like, and now I shall show you as I really am, a flaming eyeball, or the pupil of a flaming eyeball, but rather that's sort of like a vision that Gandalf gets, you know, that's something that's sort of revealed to him. And I think that works really well. You know, Alden Foster is pointing out that, you know, they do hint that the pupil of the eye was Sauron, that is, he does sort of take bodily form there. But again, I think that's him revealing himself to Gandalf, whereas he was
almost as a mental, like you said, a vision. It's almost like a mental.
Yes, yes.
Like Gandalf's getting it telepathically, almost.
Yes, it is not necessarily obvious to me that if there had been another observer sitting there, that they would have seen exactly what Gandalf saw. I don't know that that's necessarily true. I also really love the comment that Brian Biggs made a little while back. How he said that scene with Gandalf before the eye recalled to him the Witch King's line, "Thy shriveled mind be left naked to the lidless eye." I think that's a great observation. It does sound to me a lot like that. So I keep coming back, though, to Gandalf's motivation for going in, because I feel like until I can come up with a theory I'm happy with explaining that, I can't really understand right. the full sort of thematic force of this idea. Because if he's going in, there are three reasons I can think of that Gandalf is going in, and tell me if you think I'm leaving anything out. One is purely for investigation reasons, that he's determined to find out the truth, so he's going to go, at the risk that he's going to get his butt kicked, he's going to go in and discover the truth. The second is that he is arrogant, that he believes he can handle it. So he's going to go in, and he's going to put on the boots, and he's going to kick some butt, and if he needs Galadriel's help, he's got her for backup, but whatever, he's going in. The third would be self-sacrificial. That he knows he's going to get his butt kicked. He's called for help, so he knows that the cavalry is on the way, but nevertheless, he's going to go in knowing that he's very likely to get his butt kicked. And those three mm-hmm. things, this sort of the to reveal the truth, to destroy the darkness, on his own, or to sacrifice himself in order to compel the darkness to reveal itself. I feel like those have very different impacts, depending on which of those things it is.
I've got this mental image of Galadriel coming in, kicking Sauron's butt, hands on hips, looking up at him in his thing, going, "You sent Radagast to get me. You told Radagast you know it was a trap, and you didn't wait. And right. Why didn't you wait for us?"
Besides which, in Peter Jackson's world, I'm like 5 minutes away. Seriously, you couldn't wait for me?
Right.
How long did you expect me to take to get here from Lothlorien, for crying out? I didn't even have to cross the Misty Mountains, which you can do in half an hour. So, come on! Yeah.
Now, listen, I know we have a whole year to do this, so I really want to be very soft at this, but we are actually past the time allotted for this topic.
Drat! Okay.
I know. Drat. So I don't know. I mean, it's our choice. We could shorten up the other ones or...
No, let's try to push through to the end here. Okay.
Let's make one last parting comment on it. I want to acknowledge your point, Corey. The Gandalf and Radagast stuff leading up to this felt very rushed. It's sort of like
yes,
he went very quickly from I'm going to drop the dwarves off here. Oh, there's something on this tree, and I'm getting a vision from Galadriel, which it's not clear if that was a memory or a hallucination or a telepathic communication. And then I'm going to go check these things, and I'm going to write to Dolgold. It felt the pacing was all off.
Mm-hmm.
It really went yes. really, really fast.
Yes.
So I agree. I'm hoping that there's just a bunch of stuff that's been cut.
Yes. David Mosley is pointing out that you were just doing critfic there and saying that it was rushed. Yeah. So yeah. did Timothy Fisher. Yeah. And they're totally correct.
Let me rephrase. It felt rushed.
Yes.
We opened a can of worms here.
I'm not sure. I'm not saying I'm not claiming anything about the filmmakers. It just felt fast to me. I felt like
it did happen very fast. Those scenes were clipped, and they were not very clearly connected to each other. It was jarring. I felt jarred by that too.
Yes.
And I especially and again, to me, the consequence of that is exactly the uncertainty that I find myself still sitting in, which is because the buildup to that was so brief, I find myself mm-hmm. not really understanding the force of it. I don't know how to interpret it. Now, what I am willing to say, especially based on the visual imagery that we get in the final confrontation, is that we're not supposed to see this as an act simply of stupidity on Gandalf's part, nor self-sacrifice in the sense of, I know I'm going to die and I'm just going to give myself up for some reason, but rather Gandalf being willing to stand against darkness. He knows it's a trap. And yet he goes anyway because it's what he needs to do. It needs to happen. He needs to uncover the darkness because uncovering is what he does. He goes around Dol Guldur, right. Breaking the spell of concealment that has been placed upon it. That's what he... that's what he is that's the whole focus of what he's doing. So I'm willing to take that as the indicator of sort of how we're to understand this, that what Gandalf is doing is revealing the darkness, and that he is sort of forcing it to come out into the open and to show itself, which is a play on what happens in the book. That is the actual plot that happens in the stories of Gandalf discovering, you know, uncovering the fact that the necromancer really is Sauron. But it kind of goes a little further than that, because it's not just an investigative move on Gandalf's part. I presume, based on the very brief descriptions we get of this at various points in Tolkien's work, that Gandalf was never discovered, that Sauron was never the wiser that Gandalf was there. But of course,
like Scott says, reveal yourself. Don't make me sing.
That's right. So
I'm thinking somewhere between the two, you know, yeah. Of the three choices you gave, I'm thinking between the second and third. I hate to attribute arrogance to Gandalf. I just, right. You know, I just can't do it. But I do think maybe he was taking a calculated risk.
Yes.
I think he was gambling that whatever power was at Dol Guldur was something that he could contend with. So that he knew, knowing it was a trap, but that he felt up to the task.
Right.
And that there was a risk that maybe, a small risk that maybe, you know.
Right. Or at least if he was going to be overwhelmed, he had to risk that anyway, because he needed, because even knowing that Galadriel is coming, basically either he is able to defeat or drive off the darkness himself, or he will force the darkness to reveal itself and thus better equip Galadriel to handle it when she comes up.
I'm holding out for we'll get a new an additional option once we get more material.
Yes. Well, though to me this fits in with other themes that we see and other things that we're about to segue to talk about. You know, Toriel is all about confronting the darkness and standing up to it and going to find it at its source and revealing it. And Thorin also is not content to cower on the slopes of the mountain and let Bilbo go in and do his separate investigation.
Nicely done.
So
nicely done, Professor.
Thank you very much. So I would therefore say that this kind of revelation, both not just standing against the darkness, but this proactive standing against the darkness, this seeking out in order to reveal and defy the darkness, does, in my mind, count as a much larger theme of this story. Now, briefly, because we really do want to get to other things, but we can't go off without comparing it back to the book at all. I would say that theme is not in The Hobbit. That's not something that The Hobbit as a book is really, I think, concerned about. We don't get that kind of... We really don't get much of that kind of light versus darkness stuff going on in The Hobbit. I mean, there is evil, and it's very interested in good and evil and in moral choices and things like that, especially at the end. It's less interested in sort of light and darkness in that way and standing against the darkness. I don't see that in the Hobbit book. I do see that in the Lord of the Rings a good deal more. But it's interesting. I think the dynamics are different. And this is something, you know, we can come back and mull this over. We're going to be coming back to these ideas and these themes as we go through season three and think through some of this stuff in more detail. So it's okay if we don't resolve each of these themes today, but...
Let me make one... just what you made me think of when you were just talking about that is... I think it's important for us to remember that The Hobbit, by and large, is a pre-On Fairy Stories story. It's a pre-On Fairy Stories fairy story.
Right.
Meaning, you know, he had not really formed all of his final conclusions about, well, he actually didn't really finish formulating those until the 50s, did he? Because the essay really got changed even from the talk. So this was, you know, The Hobbit was written back in the days when he was still reading, you know, the goblin, you know, Princess and the Goblin and that kind of stuff. And so that Smaug really is the big bad in the story. I mean, that's kind of almost like the traditional fairy story villain, right?
Yes, yes.
Necromancer is sort of like a side thing. So, yeah, so when he wrote The Hobbit itself, it, that just wasn't really a theme he was really focused that much on, right?
Right.
Versus Lord of the Rings was a different thing.
Right, right. I'm saying light versus darkness rather than good versus evil, because good versus evil begins to become sort of sound very trite and overgeneralized from the beginning. You know, the light standing against the shadow is something that does come up quite a bit in The Lord of the Rings. Again, I think the dynamics are somewhat different. But anyway, certainly this is something. But again, here we get into the project that that Peter Jackson and company are doing, which is that, you know, it's not fair just to compare even the thematic interests of the film against only the thematic interests of the book, because it is not only the published Hobbit, of course, that they're working with. So anyway. We can kind of come back and as I say, talk about this more as we move forward. Let's move from this to our next topic. Our next topic was Toriel, and in particular the love triangle. I want to think about that a little bit more. This is, I think, more than anything, the single most off-putting for Tolkien purists and lovers, the single most off-putting theme of the film. So I want to think about that a little bit. What do we see going on in the film? What are the dynamics of this story as it's told in the film? And I think first we have to start with the conversation that Toriel and Kiwi have while he's in his comparatively luxurious prison. And what do we see there? Dave, I know that you really like that scene. What is it that you... Tell me what you think is most important about that scene and how we're supposed to be kind of taking it.
It's an interesting question. You know, actually, I have an anecdote related to this. I was rewatching this scene the other day, since Teresa has a screener of this. I am able to watch it on occasion, and I thought I had caught the screenwriters in a trap, because I wasn't sure if the Sylvan Elves, I believe Nandor is the correct term.
Yes.
I wasn't sure if they count as Eldar or not, and they had Toriel talking about, oh, the Eldar love starlight, and I was like, or love all light, and I'm like, I think I caught them in a mistake that I can rail on them for. But no, in fact, the Sylvan Elves do in fact count as Eldar.
As Eldar, yes.
Which actually brings up a really interesting question to me, I'm just sort of musing out loud, and we shouldn't get into this, but, who actually doesn't count as the Eldar, other than Aeol? He seems to be like the only person that I think you can like name and say, like, this guy for sure, not one of the Eldar.
The Avari, I think.
Yeah. But we don't really ever, I guess.
I thought all Eldar, so Eldar is not synonymous with human then. I mean, in other words, like,
right.
Humans.
Is it parallel
to it? Eldar, I thought the Eldar were the first children of Iluvatar, so that would be any elf, wouldn't it?
There is a distinction that's introduced that, like, basically only the three peoples that set out on the journey are called the Eldar.
Even if you walked 5 feet, you get to count that.
Right. And this is true. I was actually, Dave, I was thinking, because I remembered you saying that.
I got to go back and read the beginning of The Silmarillion again.
Right. Yeah. All right. I was recalling, Dave, you're making this comment or asking this question before. And when we were reading Unfinished Tales, I think it was Syros, who is one of the Nandor, in the Turin story. I think he was referred to as one of the Eldar at one point. So I was I can't put my finger on it right now, the exact passage, but as I, and I can't quote it off the top of my head, but I remember reading the Turin story and thinking of you, Dave, and thinking, oh, wait, here it is, Nandor as Eldar, there it was. So, yeah.
Aha.
So
now no.
So she does count. She is officially Eldar.
So, all right, fine.
Yeah.
So anyway, but
well, I'm relieved to know that the scriptwriters didn't get caught on such a simple thing.
Yes, thank God. then we would have just gotten sidetracked with complaining about that the whole time.
Yeah.
That's right.
So I don't know if I can put my finger on exactly what it is I liked about the scene. Maybe just because I found it to be a welcome respite in the constant barrage of action scenes. But,
right.
But I think it felt authentic. It felt very, you know, apart from my suspicion that they screwed up the elves. It felt Tolkien-esque in a sense. It was a little more. It's not the kind of dialogue he would write, but it still felt Tolkien-esque. It seemed like the kinds of things characters might discuss. It's something that. It was a place where they innovated, where they changed, they added their own material, went in a new direction, that I feel like didn't abuse the canon too badly, and it, just all in all, I, you know, going in, we were the big question mark was, so what are they going to do with Tauriel, and particularly what are they going to do with the love triangle. And like you said, Corey, at Mythmoot, we were expecting the worst, that it was going to be some kind of Tauriel and Legolas thingamabobber,
right?
You know, some kind of forbidden love type storyline, and it wasn't. And the little bit that they gave of that was irritating, but they didn't go too far down that road. And apart from the strange, crass comment that Keeley makes, which is a little out of place in a Tolkien work, but whatever, we can overlook it.
About his pants, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a little crass.
Yes, that was a little jarring.
I felt like this scene was subtle. It wasn't overtly romantic, really, in any sense. It was, it was a nice way to use Tauriel to show her as being kind of the rebel elf who understands her duty and is going to execute it, and yet at the same time can deign to condescend and have a conversation in both the physical and metaphorical senses, condescend to have a conversation with the prisoner dwarf.
Right.
And it was just a really nice moment of character development that I think was handled very well, and it wasn't handled clumsily, and it defeated my expectations, which were, you know, I'll admit, I expected it to be handled poorly and to be really irritating and dumb, and it wasn't. And for me, I think it really set up the potential to do some really interesting things in the third film when we get to the Siege of the Lonely Mountain.
Yes. Yeah. You know, Dave, I want to pick up on what you said about that seeming like a very kind of Tolkien-esque scene. I agree. The way that that seemed, the way that that scene gave me that impression was it is a scene more than any other moment in the film, I thought. That's not quite true. But up there with any of the other moments in the film, it was a scene that engaged with the world of Middle-earth. It was one of the things that really, it was a, both her description of the elvish point of view and how elves look at the world, and her interest in hearing Keeley describe the things that he has seen as he has traveled around the world, the way in which both of those characters are themselves engaged with the wonders of that world and sharing that with each other, and also, you know, getting us engaged and inviting us to imagine, not only to imagine parts of this marvelous world, but also the way that those things appear to a dwarf and to an elf. That struck me as a very Tolkien kind of thing. Or rather, though I agree, not the way Tolkien would have written that kind of dialogue had he described such a scene, but nevertheless the effect that that scene had on me as a viewer was similar to the kind of effect that Tolkien's works I think often have, in the way in which I was engaged with the world, both like the geography of the world and with the sort of the outlook on the world of the different people in it. So that I think that I thought was very effective. Brian Fattarini is saying the unexpected cross-cultural discovery of common values definitely seemed to be pointing pretty hard to the larger history of Middle Earth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally mm-hmm. agree with that. And I also like the, you know, the specific observation that Scott Farmer makes. He says, I thought it was quite interesting that to a dwarf, starlight seemed a cold light, you know, and again, thinking that, you know, from people who spend their time underground, you know, that they would not really appreciate it. So the fact that, you know, here is an elf trying to say, you know, yeah, I recognize that you don't understand the stars, that you don't really think about the stars. Let me share with you what it's like to be out with the stars. And yet, the way in which that was handled, where, of course, one of the main things that Toriel is interested in is just to hear his stories of the world, because she's not seen that much of the world, in fact. She has lived for goodness knows how long here in the Elven King's halls and in the Elven King's realm. You know, this woman might not have stepped foot outside of Mirkwood in 1,000 years. And even the fact that she's one of the Nandor, that she's one of the Sylvan Elves, she is much less... her people, I don't know when exactly Toriel was supposed to have been born, but her people anyway have quite likely been living in Mirkwood ever since the Eldar passed west over this way. You know, she is likely one of the, you know, descended from the people who did not cross and who did not ever cross the Misty Mountains. And so, therefore, she's never seen, like, her people have never been, like, they just were in the previous movie on the other side of the Misty Mountains, in the Shire. And not only Toriel herself, but her people have never been there. You know, Keeley, for all the fact that he's, you know, hundreds of years younger than Toriel, has seen way more of the world than Toriel has. So anyway, it's that element, both how she had, you know, his own experience of the world is limited because he doesn't look at the, you know, he looks at the world from this dwarvish point of view and doesn't, you know, and can't appreciate, you know, the relationship with the stars that the Eldar have. So too, she doesn't have any kind of insight into the world as a whole. She's lived this very parochial life. So anyway, I thought that was a really fascinating, Dime is reminding me that Legolas mentions to Aragorn that how Aragorn has seen so much more of the world than he, even though Legolas in other places lumps Aragorn in with the rest of the children that he's been traveling with.
No one brings up an issue that I have. There seems to be an assumption that Tauriel is 600 years old. I don't know that that's necessarily true, although maybe Boyance has said that. I don't know. The only line I heard was just Legolas saying to her something about how Thranduil for 600 years has had her under his wing. To me, that didn't necessarily mean she was 600 years old. It meant she's been like a ward, if you will, of the king for 600 years. So I think she could be older, but I don't think there's a definite answer to that question.
No, I don't.
Do you guys know?
I don't think so. It would be interesting if she were 600 years old. That would actually, in a sense, put her kind of in a parallel situation with Keeley.
With Keeley, yeah.
Because it means that she would be quite young compared to most of the other elves. So she and Keeley would be like the, you know, the two bright-eyed, young, inexperienced members of their groups, essentially.
Which, you know, could actually turn into something in the third movie.
Yes.
Those two becoming a force, you know, to try to mediate or whatever in the third movie, like the new generation with its new way of thinking and can't we all get along and blah blah blah. So that could be an interesting thing.
Yes. Harold says, Harold Johnson says that he liked the continual reference to Kiwi's youth. You know, first in the first film, he gets lambasted for joking about orcs. Here, he's the cocky young guy willing to make a dirty joke to the pretty elf at the same time that he's holding on to a token given by his mom. That all seems very deliberate. And yeah, I like that. And not just for the kind of Easter egg reference to the only female dwarf who ever gets named by Tolkien, which was Kiwi's mom. I too like that. And so, you know, one thing that we get here in, you know, starting off in that scene with Toriel and Keeley is the meeting of two worlds, and that we as viewers are invited to see that, to sort of partake in that.
Michael Lucero said he just had a horrible vision of Keely asking Tauriel to toss him in the Battle of Five Armies.
Oh, God. Please, no.
I hope not.
I have a little bit. You want me to?
Go ahead.
I'll try to keep it short. Many things about this scene, and I, unlike Dave, I envy Dave the ability to go back and actually, you know, parse out this one scene. First of all, the stone marketer in me, when I saw the stone, I'm like, oh, merchandising, that stone will be on the market, you know. Guaranteed, absolutely. But from Tauriel's point of view, I liked it because we got more than just Tauriel warrior princess. If you think about every other scene she's in, it's like, you know, she's kicking butt and taking names. And now we got to see her as more than just that, but then also as the voice, and I think you've said this before, Corey, as the voice of the elves, we got some more depth and color into what it's like to be an elf, what their worldview is like. And I think that was nicely just juxtapositions, as you said, to Keely, both dwarf elf and also world traveler versus non-world traveler. I mean, I think that whole thing was really interesting. Somebody said, David, I think, said earlier, or somebody mentioned, you know, could this be some kind of a parallel to the Gimli-Legolas relationship? That had crossed my mind. You know, this is kind of setting that up as, yes, it is possible for a dwarf and an elf to, you know, to bond. I'm not crazy about where they took it, you know, into the Lake Town holding hands thing. You know, I almost think Keely, after she saved his life, what, three times, four times, five times, there's kind of like the Middle Earth version of Transference going on here, and you could see how he'd fall in love with anybody who would be saving his life that many times. But I'm not crazy about that direction. But I do think, you know, we have here maybe a beginning of explaining how it is possible for, you know, an elf and a dwarf to really form a bond. I'm hoping that they really don't take the romance piece of it any further than they've already done.
Well, I don't know how much opportunity they're going to have to do that. But, moving ahead to that part, can I just say in passing a very brief sort of feminist issue about Tauriel, something that I think has been understressed severe. Lots of people have been saying that it's a shame that they added a female character and then, you know, had to put her in a romance plot. I think that this is that's unfair in two ways. One way, the fact that they chose to have a love story at all seems like a kind of a predictable choice. And if they were going to have a love story, who else was a candidate? You know, as you say, they added a female character and then just slapped her into a love story. They didn't just slap her into a love story. The character of Tauriel does a great deal more than just get involved in a love story. She's obviously not just there to be a love interest. So somebody to care, I mean, the way that she is the spokesperson, again, you know, she is the opposite pole of Thranduil that's a really strong role that she plays, especially in that speech that she has with Legolas, how she is the one who draws Legolas out to basically, you know, choose not to ally himself ideologically with his father, but instead to move with her to actually, you know, it is their fight, and to stand against evil and go along with the Gandalf theme there. So I thought that her role by far was a great deal more than just as a love interest. So the idea that they've taken a female character and then trivialized her by merely slapping her in as a love interest, I think is a misreading of the film and a trivializing of what she does. But the second...
No, it's crit fic.
Yeah, exactly. And this, and well, that part of it goes without saying. But the second thing that I would say is I think that the people who are interested, you know, in a feminist critique of this are paying far too little attention to what I think Peter Jackson and company deserve a lot of props for. And that is the extent to which they don't sexualize Toriel's character.
They could have easily done that. She could have shown a lot more cleavage, for instance, than she does. I know that sounds crass, but I mean, seriously, if had their goal been to, you know, to woo 16-year-old boys, they could have put her in like a clinging leather cat suit, but they didn't. Her clothes are very not revealing. I mean, she's beautiful. Yeah. You are conscious of the fact that she's very attractive, but she is, if anything, desexualized, I think, in her representation. That would have been offensive. Had they put in a female character only to make her look like a Marvel comic villainess or something, then that would have been objectionable. But here, I think, I think that This is one of the things that I'm sorry. So I just wanted to rant for a second at two ways in which I think that the that kind of feminist critique of Toriel, I think, is kind of missing the boat in a couple important ways.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's why it really strikes me as critic, because there's nothing. None of those critiques is true,
right?
As far as we've seen,
right?
They're criticizing what they imagine. They basically are attributing intentions to the filmmakers that there is no evidence that any of these things is true.
Right.
Like, so far, that's why I like this scene so much. None of those things the worst possible things anyone imagined have happened yet. As far as we can tell, she's not in a love story.
Right.
Really, honestly, all we have is the tiniest of conversations with Thingol, which there was no indication in there whatsoever that she had any interest in Legolas. It was sounded like a hypothetical. All we've seen is Legolas, you know, kind of glowering, kind of looking at her, talking at the dwarves, and then following her to Lake Town. And then we have Keeley kind of pining away after her after she's magically healed him. So far, there seems to be no evidence of an actual full-blown romance.
Right.
So I don't even know what people are criticizing.
I mean, it's true that I think it's pretty clear that, you know, she has some kind of feelings for Keeley, as she seems to be upset when the captured orc says that Keeley has been poisoned and is going to die, and that certainly does seem to inform why she runs off to Lake Town. But Dave, I think that your point is really well taken. People have been really quick to hearing people talk about the elf dwarf romance, you'd think they got married in the movie or something, you know.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen. All that happened was like the fact that the two of them are clearly like each other, and they, you know, and they very briefly hold hands at the end. And Keeley is clearly infatuated, and she's clearly interested, but no lines have been crossed of any kind yet.
No.
What we see is the fact that two people, that a dwarf and an elf, are capable of liking each other, even finding each other attractive, being interested in each other, and being willing to transgress boundaries in order to help each other and even to be together. That's nothing radical has happened yet. Nothing more radical than that has occurred. We don't have comparing it to Luthien and Beren. Well, it is, but so is but is it more radical even than Legolas and Gimli's relationship? I mean,
well, that's what I mean. That's what I was talking about in terms of that. This almost sets that up.
Yeah.
Again, back to my thing about this being before Lord of the Rings. This sort of sets up the thing of there can be this bond between a dwarf and an elf. And so then when we see it with Gimli and Legolas later, in the later story, it's not so surprising that it happens. You know what I mean? I mean, that's kind of from a movie making standpoint, I could see this being one of the purposes that this relationship serves.
Yeah,
and I do think that the bond that they formed, and I don't think it's a relationship. I mean, it's a love relationship, perhaps in the sense of the love of friends and that there's a connection. I do think something's going to come up that around this in the third movie in terms of their bond making some impact.
Yes.
During the siege, maybe, or something.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I mean, I don't want to make it sound like I'm trying to totally...
That is, all of that is like, it's still very, as long as they stay, if they stay sort of in the general vein that they're going in, I suppose that there probably is very little chance that we'll make it through to the end of the film without some kind of like on-screen kiss or something like that. But you know, I think I could even tolerate that if they kind of stay in the general vein that they're in. Like, it's not clear what is the nature of her interest in him beyond curiosity about this. You know, obviously she picked him out of all the dwarves because he is the most attractive. But nonetheless, it's fairly clear that her feelings toward him are bound up in her more general character, which is a person who's interested and cares about the outside world. She's concerned about him individually when the orc makes that comment, but she's also concerned about the outside world.
Yes.
Given the comments that she's made about Legolas, she cares about, you know, not just staying within the borders and defending her realm, but like going out and getting involved. She's non-isolationist. I think there's actually minimal evidence for really, really overt, strong romantic feelings on her part toward him. Like, none of it strikes me it's very, you know what it feels like to me? It feels like Aragorn and Eowyn.
Eowyn.
In fact, I would go so far as to say the Aragorn-Eowyn stuff in the Two Towers irritates me far more than this.
Oh, goodness, yes. Holy cow, yes. Yes.
But see, this is one of the things, this is one of the reasons why that thing at the end, when he's like, could she love me kind of thing at the end bugs me, is that I think it does take away from...
Yes, I agree with that.
It makes something so trite that it's actually something really deep, you know, this... Because I do agree with you guys. It's the bond between dwarf and elf. It's what you were just describing, Dave, about Tauriel's, you know, larger view of things. And it's, I mean, there's a lot going on here. And I just felt like that little bit at the end where he's like, can she love me? You know, just like took it down.
Yeah, that
it
was
just,
stupid.
Yeah, so that bugged me from that standpoint. Not from like that there's like this love thing going on. But it just like it demeaned everything that had gone before almost.
It
That's
did.
Probably overstating
and,
it, but
no, it, I don't think so. And I think that that was a bad line.
Yeah.
It was a failure in dialogue because it it was one step too far in making it, like he didn't have to say that, you know, as if we wouldn't have gotten it without that. You know, I feel
right.
like that was a place where they were just trying to, you know, make it sort of the one step more explicit and more overt, which really did kind of wreck things.
Yeah.
And I do think it would have been better because it does work in a more kind of mythic sense if you just leave it. That, and I say mythic because it has the implications, you know, the connections of being able to serve as that, you know, basically the way that their romantic relationship, and I'm not trying to deny that they were romantically attracted to each other, they obviously were, but the way in which that serves as this almost kind of mythic symbol of these other things, the way, you know, Trish, as you were saying, the way that it kind of fits together with all of these larger ideas and becomes a kind of symbol for that. And then that comment kind of brings it back down to
right.
to sort of the crass and literal level. But
right.
yeah.
Okay, ding, ding, ding.
Ding, ding, ding. Yeah, we were long past needing to move on about this. But again, thinking of themes now, what is the core idea? I think that these ideas, the willingness to cross boundaries, the tendency towards sort of xenophobia that the elves in particular have, you know, with Thranduil as the chief representative of the one who primarily cares about his own people and his own stuff. The willingness to...
That is true. You do get that actually, that she does actually throw his xenophobia in a, even more of a contrast.
Yes, yes.
Than you would get without her, for
and,
sure.
And yeah. The dwarves, too. You know, I mean, thinking right. about the, like, the conversation between Dwalin and Thorin about Bard, you know, that they're obviously suspecting him just because he's human, and they don't trust him because he's right. not a dwarf. And obviously, then you've got, you know, Thorin and his elf issues. There is a way in which a lot of the characters in this story are very happily prejudiced. That is, they're quite cheerful and unapologetic in their own racial prejudices. And Toriel, you know, Toriel and Kiwi become line crossers there. And that is something, I mean, again, that I do link, and I have been linking ever since I saw the film, with a theme at the end of the Hobbit, even the published Hobbit book. The battle of three armies that almost happens, and the battle of five armies that does happen, is a lot about those lines. I mean, when we've got the three camp, you know, when we've got the elves and the humans and the dwarves facing off against each other in front of the Lonely Mountain, one of the big questions is: is anybody going to cross those lines? Is anybody willing
right.
To recognize that you are not necessarily the enemy? I should not be looking at you with suspicion and possibly loathing just because of what you are. Are we going to, all of us, humans, elves, and dwarves, make again the larger community that used to exist back in the old days before the dragon came, or are, in fact, we going to follow the dragon's lead and continue to look out for number one, either personally or racially? So in that way, I do think, and especially I'm thinking in terms of... I'm thinking in terms of the setup for the Battle of Five Armies and for the standoff at the Lonely Mountain, that I think this is obviously mm-hmm. going to become a really prominent theme in the films. So anyway, okay.
Speaking of which, there's a segue for you.
There we go.
Speaking of the Lonely Mountain,
Thorin. So, and okay, I'll try to be briefer about that. Okay, no, that's going to fail. But anyway, Thorin and the Lonely Mountain. So Thorin and the Return of the King theme. This is something which is, of course, one of those elements which has been made much more consistent from the beginning of the story in the film than was so in the book. By the time we get to chapter 10, the return of the king theme is a very prominent one in the book. And we have, you know, the king returning to his destined to reclaim his land and the restoration of the countryside to its former peace and prosperity. As soon as we get to chapter 10 in Lake Town and we start singing songs of the old days, and Thorin stands up and says, "I am Thorin, son of Thran, son of Thror, king under the mountain, I return." We're there in the book. We are not there in chapter one. That's not what they're talking about. It comes up like they want to reclaim, but they're mostly focused on their treasure in chapter one. The issue of Thorin as a king and the king returning, and certainly any sense that there is like a destiny or prophecy that the king will return, is not there in chapter one of the published Hobbit. So one of the things, obviously, that the films have done is to take that concept of Thorin primarily not just as a very important dwarf who is the leader of these dwarves who are trying to reclaim the treasure, but of Thorin as king in exile, who is thinking like a king in exile and who wants to reclaim his kingdom and who wants to do that. That's, yeah, and Yana says, I doubt Tolkien had even thought of that when he wrote chapter one. He certainly hadn't. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that he hadn't. You can see it because when he does, by the time we get to the chapter 10 material in his drafts, we can see him, sort of thinking about, you know, very different ideas. A lot of that stuff was stuff that occurred to him as he was drafting, at least as the evidence of the surviving drafts seem to suggest. But anyway, so this is something that the film has raised to more prominence, not out of nowhere, but by projecting it back to the beginning, and here following the model of The Quest of Erebor, where we see Thorin acting and talking like a king also from the beginning. And Gandalf even kind of taking him to task for that, saying, you know, you're thinking of, you know, armies and alliances and things like that. You don't have armies. You don't have alliances. Instead, Gandalf suggests, you know, you should go as a small group on this separate quest instead of thinking in terms of trying to rally armies. The film kind of compromises between those things by having Thorin attempt to rally armies and fail to rally armies. And so that's why, you know, when he comes to meet them at Bilbo's house at the beginning, he tells them that the rest of the dwarves won't come. And that his armies are unavailable. So the mere fact of the prominence of this idea of Thorin returning to the mountain and reestablishing the kingdom is a really important theme. It's something that emerges in the book as we move along. And the parallels that some people have pointed to, either in praise or blame, between Thorin as Return of the King and Aragorn as Return of the King, I think it makes perfect sense.
Hobbit is like Lord of the Rings in miniature. I mean, even in the book, more so than the movie, you even start out with Thorin being kind of a doddering old man in the beginning. You know, like you have Strider, definitely right. Not very kingly in the beginning. You know, and he becomes kingly as the story goes on. I mean, there's so many parallels. The journey, you know, the eastward journey. I mean,
yes.
And all of it's, you know, getting caught in the mountains. I mean, there's just little details all the way along the line. Gandalf leaving, you know, under
right.
different circumstances, granted.
Right.
You know, there's so much. And I told you, as I said to Corey before we started, that I just am kind of, I scratch my head that there are some people that actually criticize the Hobbit movie for being like Lord of the Rings in this regard. Because my response is, well, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, the books are.
Right, right.
That's something they got right.
Yeah, exactly. It is. It is something that they got right. And basically,
regardless,
I feel like...
I like it.
Uh-huh?
I actually, in terms of on-screen stories being told, I like this one better. Thorin's a lot less mopey than film Aragorn.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. He's a lot more sure of his kingliness, isn't he?
Yeah,
and
If I can just take one moment to indulge in a Lord of the Rings complaint. I hated the Aragorns, human beings are bad people, and my forefathers are bad guys, so I really shouldn't just be king. I'm just going to be a ranger in the wild and kind of do my thing. It's like, oh, come on, you destroyed him. And I really don't like Elrond, this like snobby high elf Elrond.
Right.
I don't know. I found those characters to be... Thin facades, really thin, crappy just like there's so much depth to both those characters from the books, and they just threw it all out and just did these really thin shell, stereotype cliche characters. And instead, what we have here, which I think is much more effective, is a really, really nice story where Thorin is deep and conflicted. Not cliche conflicted like the Aragorn in the films, like, oh, I don't know if I want to do it, but Thorin is like legitimate, like he wants to be king. He wants to reclaim his homeland, but the reason that the reason he's conflicted is he has all these competing desires. He's
right.
not sure if he's sort of the ruthless king who's willing to sacrifice his soldiers to get it done, or is he the loyal friend who's going to run down and save Bilbo from the dragon.
Did you like Elrond better in The Hobbit?
He wasn't on screen enough to be sure, but he seemed like a happier guy in general.
He did.
Yes.
With that.
Much less cranky.
You know, he
certainly.
Was like, hey!
Yeah.
He was good times Elrond.
Yeah, yeah. No, I do agree about the story of Thorin, and I think that the way that, you know, conflicts in his character come in do make much more sense and show him struggling. You're right, the Aragorn in the movie sort of talks about human weakness and he's all worried that he's going to screw up, but we never actually see him screwing up or anything. You know, it seems like he's just moping about it. Whereas
we see Aragorn in the book screwing up more than Aragorn in the movie.
Right, right.
Yeah, he has that moment, when the fellowship's breaking, where he says, you know, basically, I'm paraphrasing, all of my decisions go wrong. Right. I couldn't possibly make a good decision at this point if my life depended on it.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Whereas with Thorin, we see the actual sort of struggles and challenges in front of him. You know, is he going to be, you know, we have, as I was suggesting after An Unexpected Journey, the way that Azog serves as a foil for him, you know, the, you know, crazy dismembered guy dedicating his life to vengeance. Like, Thorin, are you going to let yourself be a crazy dismembered guy dedicating your life to vengeance? Is that what you're really about? You know, that combined with a conversation with Balin in Bag End, where Balin's like, you know, you don't have to do this. You've built a good life for us. If your concern is just providing for your people, you know, you've done that. Let's just move forward. It's possible. We could just move forward with what we have. I think that's really interesting, the way that that's built up. And then the way that the dragon sickness stuff gets kind of worked into that through the second film, I think becomes really interesting. And we'll focus on those things a little bit in more detail, you know, as we go on to talk about Thorin more throughout season three. To me, the biggest place where this became an issue in the Desolation of Smaug was in Thorin's invasion of the mountain and confrontation with Smaug. And there, you know, again, obviously this is one of the things that lots of Tolkien fans have, you know, sort of pointed to as a place where, you know, the film now becomes totally irrelevant to the book. But it's very interesting because, again, what we see Thorin doing is acting like a king instead of like comic relief, which is what the dwarves act like through a lot of the time in the book. And I, you know, it is really hard to see if you think of the way that I have come to, you know, in my own head, think about the Hobbit films is, and this is, you know, in trying to answer the question or address the question, I've begun to think that this question in its very terms is a sort of a misleading question when people want to ask how true to the books are the Hobbit films. And I think that that's actually in its very terms, a kind of misleading question. How I view the Hobbit films is the Hobbit films are a thought experiment based upon the books. Because the thought experiment is, what would the Hobbit story look like? What would you have to do to the Hobbit story to bring it into line with the overall story, as Tolkien later on came to be? Like, basically, in 1960, Tolkien sat down to revise The Hobbit. He only got a little bit of a ways into it, and it was pretty dreadful. And the reason the 1960 Hobbit, I think, is pretty dreadful, is that he doesn't actually change much. He just goes back and he keeps the story very similar, adds some details, like in chapter two with the chapter with the trolls, he's concerned about geography. You know, now, of course, by the time it's come to 1960, he's written The Lord of the Rings. He now has the geography between the Shire and Rivendell pretty well mapped out through the Fellowship of the Ring. So he's annoyed by the fact that the description of the journey of Bilbo and the dwarves from the Shire to Rivendell doesn't fit with the geography that he's already worked out. So he adds in a lot of the geography, and he changes the tone. He doesn't want to have the same narrator tone that he had in The Hobbit. He doesn't want to do the children's book thing anymore. So he basically strips the narrator's voice of all that made it funny and endearing, so that it sounds like the same things happen, but it's really flat. In other words, the changes that he makes, that he starts making when he does the first two chapters of the 1960 Hobbit, are really kind of flattening because they're mostly reductions. They're not additions. He doesn't actually reconceive the story, even to the same extent that he reconceived it in The Quest of Erebor. So basically, right, how I've come to think about the films is as a thought experiment. If in 1960 Tolkien had actually been willing to say, all right, let's redo that chapter of the story to now actually make it fit with the characters as I've unfolded them, with the world as I've unfolded it, with the overall plot of the Third Age as I've described it, taking all of those things into account, let's do the Hobbit story again. And do it in a way so that it is not only consistent from beginning to end, but also so that it is so that it actually fits with that larger world. And that's what we see in so basically that's a project which is by necessity, by its very definition, is going to leave behind the actual events of the book at many times because the events of the book don't fit with that world always anymore. And I think, so to me, this is the thought experiment that Peter Jackson and company are doing. And if you are undertaking that thought experiment, when you come to the Lonely Mountain, and if you ask the question, what would the Thorin that we meet at the Battle of Azanul-Bazar in Appendix A, what would the Thorin that we meet in the Quest of Erebor, what would Gimli do when he gets back to Erebor? Would he cower on the mountainside and make speeches and shush Bilbo? And he has that one really awesome moment of leadership, you know, where he tells Balin and Fili and Kili and Bilbo to go into the tunnel. The dragon shan't have all of us. That's a really great moment for Thorin. But it's impossible for me to imagine Thorin in particular, or the dwarves in general, as they come to be envisioned post Lord of the Rings, it's impossible for me to imagine those dwarves, as opposed to the published Hobbit dwarves, who were still largely comical children's story dwarves, it's impossible for me to imagine Thorin and them cowering on the side of the mountain. That would be... There is a way in which depicting what actually happens in the book would be less true to dwarves as Tolkien came to depict them than what Peter Jackson actually did. So what do you do? And having Thorin confront Smaug, I can't imagine that Thorin wouldn't do that. I really can't.
So again, in parallel to Aragorn, that's like Aragorn going on the Pass of the Dead. I mean, that's you know, if you look at Thorin being sort of the Aragorn of this story, it does totally make sense that he would go in.
Yes, of course he would go in. So, you know, and it's... But again, this is really hard because in this, as in the, you know, the idea of an elf-dwarf romance, there's no response to, you know, a purist who says, but that never happens in Tolkien. You know, that doesn't happen in the books. You know, there is no evidence that any dwarf or elf ever found each other anything other than physically repulsive. Okay, I mean, obviously Gimli admires Galadriel. But you know, there's certainly no evidence that any elf ever found any dwarf less than ugly at any point in Tolkien's work. Well, no, of course, no, there's not. And there's no argument that's the case. But this is what frustrates me about that, is I find that really, really superficial. Okay, yes, all of the elves that we meet find the dwarves physically repulsive. Does that mean that that line is uncrossable? Is the crossing of that line something which is intrinsically alien to the Tolkien world? And I say no. We get love which bridges those kinds of divides on several occasions in Tolkien. With Thorin here, again, the same thing. No, of course Thorin doesn't do this. Yes, of course, it's a major change from the plot of the published Hobbit. But is it in fact untrue to Thorin and the dwarves and the story as Tolkien came to understand it? I say no. In this way, I think this is why, you know, many people saw and commented on that article by Neal Stephens that I tweeted about several days back, where Neal Stephens, who wrote that article, made the, you know, somewhat deliberately provocative statement that the Hobbit films are truer to Tolkien's book than Tolkien's Hobbit was. And of course, that's a hyperbolically stated remark on purpose. But I actually think that I, in a lot of ways, I generally agree with him. The Hobbit, the published Hobbit, is more out of pace with the world that Tolkien came to depict than for much of it, especially in the first half of it, than the films are, I think.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, especially if you think about the fact that he was writing Silmarillion-type legendarium material from the early, you know, the late 1910s. In the late 1920s, early 30s, The Hobbit was out of pace with the rest of what he was writing.
Absolutely. It was a deliberate departure. Right, he wasn't trying to do the same thing. And I think this is to me not undermined but emphasized by the way in which he incorporates those Silmarillion elements into the Hobbit story. Because when you look closely at them, and I've made this argument in other places, especially in my Mythgard class on The Hobbit, when you look at many of those elements, and I'll point to one thing in particular, the references to Gondolin, they're actually inconsistent, not only with the published Silmarillion, but with what he was writing about the mythology in the same year that he wrote The Hobbit. I mean, right at that, what he was writing at that time is inconsistent with it. In other words, he's not connecting the stories. He's recycling the idea, in some sense, of Gondolin. But the way he describes Gondolin and the orcs' relationship to Goblin, you know, the goblins' relationship to Gondolin, the way he describes that in chapter 4 of The Hobbit flatly contradicts the legend of Gondolin that he was currently writing at that time, and any form it ever took thereafter.
I have this picture of Dad, like, pacing the study floor as the children are sitting on the floor listening, and he's, like, pulling ideas, you know, as he's, like, creating this story sort of stream of consciousness, and he would naturally pull that in, like he used Fingolfin as the, you know, was the Orc King's name originally, and then had to go back and change it, but it was because golf, you know, he wanted to make the golf pun.
Exactly.
So I definitely get the picture of him when he first formed the story of just sort of like pulling stuff out, and of course he would pull in some stuff from things he's already writing.
Of course.
You're right, there's no connection.
He's got all this material in his mind. Yeah, he wants somebody who bridges the world of humans and elves and is kind of this frontier figure. He's got Elrond. You know, he's got a character named Elrond who already exists and who can be recycled, but he's clearly recycled. Look at the description of Elrond in chapter 3 of The Hobbit. It contradicts the Silmarillion story of Elrond, both at that time and in the published Silmarillion. It's simply not true. I don't even know how many years of my life trying to reconcile those two things, by the way. That reference in The Hobbit always bothered me. For some reason, that always kind of jumped out at me and bothered my teenage self quite a bit. The reference to how, there were people in that time who had both elves and men as ancestors, and Elrond was their chief. And boy, did I try, you know, as soon as I read the Silmarillion, I like was holding the book sideways and trying backwards and forwards to reconcile that with the statement in The Hobbit, and inventing all of these ways in which you could possibly construe it. But the fact is, you can't. It doesn't. And again, the point is not that Tolkien is making mistakes. That's not at all what I'm trying to say. What I am trying to say is when he wrote The Hobbit, he was doing something totally different. Taking these names, taking these ideas, and recycling them, and reusing them, and repurposing them in The Hobbit. But what he was doing in The Hobbit was a totally different thing. So again, The Hobbit films are the thought experiment. What if you tell the story of Thorin and Bilbo in a way which is, from the beginning, part of that world? Part of that story, part of that tradition. And the fact is, Tolkien never did that. He never completed the process of naturalizing The Hobbit into that world. He did a bunch of things towards it, but he never fully, thoroughly did that. And the published Hobbit, even the revised published Hobbit, and even all of the things that he either started or fragments that he did and references that he made, there's a lot of material, if you put it all together, of his later rethinking of The Hobbit. But he still never actually did the full thing to reconsider and redo the Hobbit story within that world. So I don't, for this reason, you know, I am not going to hold the Thorin thing against him. Now, when I think about thematically, how does it work in the film? What is the core of that? To get back to our initial idea, what is the core of that thing? Well, the core of that is Thorin struggling with with his own identity, his being king under the mountain, who is the real king under the mountain, and Thorin wanting to insist on that. Now, and again, it's connecting, I think, to the, you know, light proactively standing up against darkness theme. And with Thorin, it gets further complicated by the fact that you have, for Thorin at that moment in the film, not only the external darkness of the evil dragon who has taken over his kingdom that he has to go in and stand up against, but also his own darkness, that, you know, this sort of moral darkness that is threatening to overwhelm him. And I do think that we are shown, and I wasn't expecting this, I do think that we are shown at the end of the film a Thorin who has, at least in one sense, and at least at this moment, conquered his dragon sickness. I think that what we see of Thorin at the end is not a Thorin who's going further and further off the rails, but a Thorin who has a good moment. I thought when we saw in that one late trailer, the line where Thorin says, "We will all burn together," you know, "if we will burn, then we'll all burn together." I first took that as basically Thorin off the rails. You know, I thought, I was like, "Oh boy, that sounded really bad." You know, I think that you know, we're seeing Thorin in sort of an advanced state of moral corruption here. In the actual film, I didn't think that was how it came across at all. That, in fact, seemed to me to be a turning point for Thorin. And his decision to take action, and when they go down and start the highly improbable sequence of events down at the Forges of the Dwarves, which I found practically ridiculous, but symbolically really cool, that seemed to me a really positive step by Thorin. Timothy is asking, you know, is Thorin fighting the dragon sickness by conquering the dragon? By standing up against him, yes. And I thought even the way that it worked, the significance, the symbolic significance of Thorin taking not only a whole bunch of gold in the molten gold, but the very image of his grandfather, the very, you know, the image of the king under the mountain in a molded gold statue. I mean, that is such a condensed symbol of Thror and Thror's dragon sickness and everything that Thorin could become, that it looks like Thorin is almost destined to reenact. And he is not, he's taking almost exactly the opposite posture from his grandfather. Instead of gathering all the gold together and sort of having his eyes turned inward and focusing on it, he's sacrificing the gold. He's using that gold as a booby trap. He's using that gold to fight against the dragon instead of just, you know, having this covetous relationship with it himself. Brian, I exactly agree. As Brian was just saying, everything leading up to that moment in the film was preposterous, but the payoff of those few seconds was so worth it. Brian, that's exactly what I agree. What I felt. I was like, okay, that was kind of silly. But worth it is exactly what I was thinking. That moment when he is confronting Smaug, and we see Smaug drawn to the gold, but Thorin has shaken himself free from it. And then you add on, as Yana is pointing out, you know, the sort of Easter egg of the river of running gold, you know, sort of the Lake Town song made literally true. Loved it. Loved it.
Now, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. Where do you think, I'm talking strictly movie now, we start out very clearly, Thorin, all he wants is for Bilbo to go in and get the Arkenstone. There is no consideration at that point of going in themselves and fighting the dragon. When we get to the point where he says, "We'll burn together," I think he's already made the decision. Where do you think he makes that decision? Where do you think it stops being about just grab the Arkenstone and then I'm going to go get my people and we're going to come back, versus, okay, I need to go in and get them? I'm thinking it might be when he sees the burned dwarves, or, you know, but I'm not sure.
I think it's earlier. I think it's when the secret door opens.
Yes. Okay.
I think it's when the secret door opens. That moment, and this was, the number one. And I don't care if people were offended by this. This was the biggest moment in the movie that I was sitting there and I was actually thinking to myself, that is so much better than the book. So much better than the book. when Thorin and when Balin has that tearful moment, when we see the tears standing in Balin and Thorin's eyes as they cross the threshold and they re-enter Erebor for the first time, I cried. I both times I saw the movie, I cried at that moment. That was really moving, and moving in exactly the way that we would expect Tolkien's dwarves to be moved. When they have that moment, that was really powerful. And so for me, Trish, that's the moment when he's in Erebor again. He's not going to leave his own kingdom now. You know, he might have originally been thinking, let's open the secret door, let's send in the burglar. But if that had been his original thought, when he's there in Erebor again, yeah, as Harold says, you know,
he realizes he can't do it. That,
you know, as Harold is reminding me of the line, "I know these stones." Yes. Once he is back, now he is the king. He has returned to his kingdom, and he is not going to give it up. And he is not going to he's not going to leave without a fight. And again, that works for me. That makes sense to me. It makes a great deal more sense. I have a hard time reconciling Thorin's reaction in the book, which is to turn and make that pompous speech to Bilbo about how now it's time for the burglar to earn his reward while they're all going to sit outside and wait for him. Thorin
and
in that
then they
moment
sit
in the book.
And all they do is reminisce.
Yeah.
I mean, they sit outside and all they do is tell each other stories about the good old days.
Exactly. I can't reconcile that with the Thorin that we get in Tolkien's later concept of Thorin and his later concept of the dwarves. I do think that that's the moment. And who knows? I mean, it's kind of interesting the fact that we never really learn what their plan was. That is, we only hear about the theft of the Arkenstone once the secret door is open. This is news to Bilbo and news to us at that point. So we never really know exactly the full extent of what their plan had been. You know, did they actually change it by entering the mountain? I'm not sure. But certainly in any case, it is a moment where I think that's sort of the moment of no return for him. Okay, well, we are over time.
Oh, you notice I haven't bothered to crack.
I know. And so Trish is waving the white flag here and totally giving
this
up on reining us in. Well, we're going to do... Maybe we save the review for next week? Maybe we lead with that?
I don't even know that we necessarily need to review. I mean, my feeling about... Well, I don't think we should, because now we're going to really be time-crunched when we start the riddles next
time.
Yeah,
you're right.
But, first of all, I just want to... In my defense, I just want to say one of the reasons I let this go on is because this is our last time we're really going to be talking with any depth about Desolation of Smaug. So I felt this was more important than breaking to go through the riddles.
Right.
What I would suggest maybe we do is just simply acknowledge who the winners were this year, thank our judges, and, you know, if you have anything specific you want to say, you know, or generally you want to say, rather than go through every single riddle, which people can easily get to on our site, we could do that to shorten the time.
Sure. Why don't you go through
I told Yana, I mean, people have kind of moved on now, so we don't necessarily want to spend a whole lot of time on.
Right. No, that does make a lot of sense. So Trish, why don't you go? Why don't you go through and do
so
the
answer? Yeah. Give the answers. Okay. All right. Let me do that. Oh, the winners.
The winners is what I meant. Yeah.
I got it. Okay. Yeah. So our top three winners this year were Scott Farmer at 30.5 points. And I'm trying to remember, I think there was a possible 43, if I'm remembering that right.
41.
41. Okay. Yeah. We weighted the right, a correct riddle answer was worth 2 points. A correct conundrum answer is worth one. That's how we come to 41. So 30.5 for Scott Farmer. Jacob Sorensen was in second at 27.5 and Brianna Melvin at 27. So Bray won last year. She's still in the top three. She got the bronze this year, but, you know, that's still pretty darn good.
Yes.
How
still
far
are
you falling, Brianna?
Overall.
And I
want
to thank Brianna and Jana Stina Redeker and Steven Schoenfeld were our judges this year, and I want to thank them for stepping up and taking on the job. And, in fact, those three are going to be hosting the Digest this year. Probably it'll start a couple of weeks after our first riddle episode, so sometime in February. So you'll be hearing them on the Digest podcast.
Right. Good. Yes. And I think, one of the things that's really fascinating about the process, about sort of the evaluation process is, you know, I think it's one of the things that makes the riddles a lot of fun is, you know, not only are they fun to talk about in advance, they're still fun to talk about afterwards. and it is for me the thing that has made this whole process so intellectually stimulating and so rewarding is that you know, it's, I find that these riddles are wonderful stimulants to analysis and to careful thought about the films. So even trying to go through and evaluate which one is the right answer is not a no-brainer. That is to say, for the majority of the questions. And, you know, there's a lot of debate and discussion we could have, you know, and I would say there are some of the answers that our judges decided were correct that I don't necessarily agree with. I would debate, if asked to you know, be analyzing the films and talking about them, but you know, again, to me, that's what's really sort of interesting about them, and I think it might be fun. I'm sort of thinking about next year, and I'm actually kind of wondering if we might want to sort of expand that process a little bit for this coming year, to kind of get more people involved with that kind of discussion. So we'll see how we're going to handle that when we come towards the end of the season this year. But yeah, for those of you who are new.
You're striking fear in my heart, Corey.
Well, of course, you know, one of the things that you can hear underlying that particular statement is if we were to do that, it would mean that we wouldn't have to end so soon. You know, a lot of people have been saying, well, what are we going to do next year when season 3 is done? Well, that will be the end of Riddles in the Dark. But for people who want to hang on to it a little while longer, we could still have some further follow-up discussions. Anyway, those of you who are new, who have come into this podcast series late, I just want to say we will have voting starting next episode, which will be 2 weeks from today. Starting in our next episode, we're going to have our first riddle of season 3, and you will be able to submit your vote for that riddle. Once we finish with the riddles, which we're planning to do by August or so, we will cut off the official, you know, if you want to officially enter the competition, you will have to submit your answers to the riddles that we will be asking by then. And then we will tally our results and see who our winner is for later on, but we'll see. The actual mechanism that we have used to do the riddles has been in flux through the last 2 years. We used to use Facebook polls, but then Facebook, as they always do, went back and arbitrarily changed those, so we can't do it the same way anymore. But anyway, so I think we're still kind of perfecting the mechanism for
season. What we'll do is we will be posting. It'll be like a PDF ongoing page that people can look at of our answers. You know, how we've answered. So it'll be the riddle and our answer. So it basically will build the form,
right?
People can vote. We'll have people vote live. You know, in our episode. But people won't actually be submitting their final answers until, you know, the end of the game.
Right.
In the meantime, we can chat about it on Twitter and on Facebook and on the Tolkien Professor page and all that good stuff. So, and the folks on the Digest, the Digest is all about really talking about what people have been, how people have been responding to the riddle episodes. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of talk about it, but people won't need to actually finalize their answers until the end of the game.
Yes. Yes. Right. Good. So just to end, then we've got a couple announcements. As I said, our first announcement is that 2 weeks from today we'll be doing our next episode and starting the riddles. And our theme for the topic of our discussion next week will be. Are we doing the action sequence? I'm now blanking.
Yes, action and violence.
Yes.
Next week.
Action and violence in the Hobbit films.
Buddy.
That's going to be. Dave has been really waiting to talk about this. I think this is a really important issue to talk about, and especially since this has been something that lots of people have observed, and I think with perfect justification. But I also think that even though I find the objection to the amount of violence and the number of action sequences in the Hobbit films is, I find, a perfectly valid criticism. Yet I think that it seems there too that a lot of people are not really thinking about it enough. I would like to see more actual analysis to think about how it works. What really are the to what extent and in what ways does it differ from what Tolkien does? What are the consequences and the sort of you know, the what kind of results does it have for the films, and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, we're going to be talking about that issue. We're going to be taking a serious look at that question for next time, and thinking, of course, since we're going to be doing our first riddle, we're going to be thinking towards film three as well, and not merely looking back at the Desolation of Smaug in that discussion. So that will be our topic for next week. Other upcoming things we have, of course, as many of you have also been involved with, I am currently doing through the Mythgard Academy a live class on Unfinished Tales. We just had two sessions this past week and have now finished the First Age material from Unfinished Tales, and we're moving on to Numenor this coming week. So if you want to talk about Alderaan and Arrendis and the Kings of Numenor and all three of the first three Numenorean chapters of the Second Age material of Unfinished Tales, feel free to join me. That's 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday evening. You can go to the Mythgard Academy page. Again, just Google Mythgard and Unfinished Tales and you'll find it. And it will give you the link for our session on Tuesday night. So everyone is, of course, welcome to join me for that. That's been a lot of fun, and been an increasing number of people that have been joining in with that. I was kind of surprised to notice when we post the files of that class to an iTunes U course as well. And when I logged into the iTunes U course to upload the files from Tuesday and Wednesday's class sessions this past week, I noticed that we've gained 1,000 subscribers on the iTunes U course over this past week. There are now 1,400 people following that class on iTunes U, which is really cool. So a lot of people have been joining us, and that's been great. So definitely, it's been a lot of fun. I felt like the discussion that we had of Turin Turambar over the last three class sessions really. Has been, I feel like I learned more about the Turin story from those sessions than any other time that I've really been studying it. I am way happier and more satisfied with the Turin story after that discussion than I've ever been. I think that's been really fun. So the next Riddles in the Dark session is in 2 weeks. The next Unfinished Tales session is next week on Tuesday, so just in a few days. Good. Is there anything else? Oh yes, Trish. The one last thing that we just wanted to mention. We don't have too many details that we can release yet, but for those of you who were able to join us at MythMoot this past year, that is the annual conference of the Mythgard Institute. We have been doing some planning. We're much further ahead than we were last year this time, and actually planning this. And in fact, very soon, probably within the next couple weeks, the next 2 or 3 weeks, probably, I'm gonna hold a live session for people who are sort of a general interest session, where I'm gonna be presenting to people the plans that we have for MythMoot, getting some feedback and ideas from people to sort of run past you what we are thinking of right now. So for those of you who are interested to actually come and join us for our conference, it has been a really fun experience for all of us who have been able to make it. Now Yana is chiding me for taunting the Europeans and people who live oceans away. Now Yana, I will say there were a couple Europeans who have made it to MythMoot, but of course I understand that it's very difficult and most people can't. But you know, we're doing what we can, Yana. Perhaps someday we will have.
Yana's a hop, skipping away from the Greisinger Museum. So
exactly.
Taunt us with that.
Exactly. You have your own advantages, and who knows? Perhaps someday we will do a Mythgard Europe conference. That would be fun. But
hey, there's nothing stopping people from organizing one.
It's true. Yeah.
That's right.
If people want to do that, talk to me. We'll see what we can do. but anyway, yeah, that would definitely be a lot of fun, and someday that might happen. But we're not planning that right now. Alden's asking, where is it going to be? Right now we're thinking of Baltimore again. Baltimore is where it's been. That has been a really convenient location. It's the convenience of that location is something that we are having a hard time replicating in other spots on the East Coast. So we will be almost certainly. Of course, Dime suggests Fairbanks, Alaska, as being the second most obviously convenient place to hold Mythmoot. And I agree, Dime. For almost everybody else, that would be probably more convenient, but we're probably going to selfishly keep it.
Well, except, see, Corey drives to Mythmoot, so Fairbanks. Yeah, a little far. It's true.
That would be, oh my goodness. Boy, would my son be excited if we were going to drive to Fairbanks, though. He would love that. Though I have to think that driving to Fairbanks in January might not be a great idea. No. But anyway.
Well, you left that cat out of the bag. You just let a cat out of the bag.
Well, you know, January, December. I mean, heck, even in the spring, it wouldn't be spring. Well, no, I'm not trying to hide it. You know, what I'm doing here is a teaser announcement, so I'm willing to drop some teasers here. So. Anyway, these are the things that we're thinking of. So keep in mind, just stay alert for future announcements about that. We will be inviting you guys to join us for a discussion of that. So anyway, I think that's all the announcement. Did I forget anything, Trish?
I don't think so. I think we're good.
Okay. Well, then I will thank everybody for joining us as always. And thanks for listening, and Godspeed.